Hit it. I'm waiting for the blue.
There it is.
Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's March 20th, 2017. We're going to got a number of bills today. We're going to start off with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 806. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 806 appropriates $20,000 from the general fund to the Oregon Business Development Department to support the Reedsport Public Library. The measure has has declared emergency, and so it would become effective upon passage. It has a fiscal impact statement that indicates what should be an obvious $20,000 fiscal impact, and it has a statement of no revenue impact. We did get a notification from Legislative Fiscal Office that they are requesting that this measure have an added referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
Those tightwads. We were ready to move it out, Senator. You're up.
Okay, thank you. For the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay, and then into the valley at Sheridan Falls City. We're here because I have a persistent, consistent group of people in the Reedsport area that followed up on a commitment that I have made to all my constituents that if you really want a bill and you keep talking to us and have a plan, I will submit it. This one I actually really agree with. Some of those I have done. I have told them, you're on your own. I'll show you how to do this, but you're on your own to get it to the right place. As a high school principal, I really understand the need and belief in libraries. I think they're really important to communities. And as I have come to know my local library, schools are a great place for kids to get introduced to libraries. But our senior citizens and others really use libraries in another way to make sure that their days are filled with appropriate things to read and the kinds of things that they want to do, they can go and find out about it at their public library. Douglas County, because of all of their difficulties in their budget, has decided to cut all funding to public libraries. And so Reedsport, and you'll hear from the mayor and the city chair, our manager and others, to talk about why it's important for Reedsport, and in particular that they have a plan and they're working hard to figure out it with $20,000 we can get it and then maintain it over time so they can run their own library. But they've tried to get grants. They've done other kinds of things to save this. They have been unsuccessful. They came to me to say, could we get $20,000? We know it's not a big ask. But for us, it's the difference between having a library and not having a library. So I'm here today to say I think it's worth having a library. I don't think it's a lot of money, but I do think that, and I don't mind it going to Ways and Means. I'll fight for it there and look to see if I can find it with the help of Senator Girard and others. Just to put him on the spot, I will. I assume it would go to his committee, subcommittee. So, my hope is that you will look on it kindly and have a conversation with the people from Reedsport who really want to make sure that they continue to have a local library. So, well, with
are,
that,
they are here.
So. They are here. So I will get up and let them. And unless you have any questions.
I just was going to tell you, your boss is here.
Yeah, they're having another committee that I have to go testify on. That
but
I'm
you need
on.
To be someplace else. Yeah, she's
exactly. So, questions?
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And next up I have, it looks like, Jonathan Wright and Linda McCollum.
Chair, if I may, let Mayor McCollum speak first.
Sure.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mayor.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, excuse me, and committee members, and thank you for allowing us to speak. As Senator Roland just said, our library will be closing this April 1st, so that's not very far.
Mayor, can I get you to put your name on the record, please?
Linda McCollum, City of Reedsport, Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you.
And this library serves not only just Reedsport, but all of Western Douglas County, which is Winchester Bay and Gardner and the small areas of Scottsburg and Wells Creek. So it's a lot of people. It's not just Reedsport. And the library in Roseburg, if it were to stay open, it's still an hour and 40-minute drive to Roseburg for a library. So our people just cannot do it. We have a high population of low-income people and older people who use the library regularly. And today, the only way you can apply for a job or benefits is through a computer. And a lot of people cannot afford their own computer. If they have one, they don't have the internet. So this is where they get it from us. And so it's very important for our small community. $20,000 is not a lot, but it'll help us get over the hump till we can help find out what we can do. We've talked to different library systems near us in Florence and in Coos Bay to see if there's any way we can join forces with them. So we just have to do something to keep our library going, and this will help us greatly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor.
And Chair.
Mr. Chair. Chair, you have it.
Oh, I'm sorry, just a second. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Mayor, we were just through Reedsport last summer, and you've got a really cute little museum.
Yes.
That's right in the middle of town. Is the library going to be anywhere near that museum? Because I could see some interplay between museum and the library.
No, they are the museum that's down on the river.
Yeah.
Right. No, it's not. Well, it's 5 or 6 blocks from there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's
so it's walking distance.
Anyway, I was very impressed. It's a
good.
Nice,
yeah, the Discovery
nice
Center
museum.
Yes. Thank you very much. The city runs that.
Yeah. Thank you. Yep.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Beyer. Good afternoon, Business and Transportation Committee members. Actually, to answer your question, Senator Monroe, we are using our volunteer coordinator from the Discovery Center in order to facilitate the running of the library from this point forward until we can find a more stable source of funding. So it will be through volunteer efforts, and that is the resources that we're tapping into with the knowledge base and structuring. The Reedsport Library is a cornerstone, just like any library is in the community. Mayor McCollum already explained how far we are from our county seat and that it's not likely that our citizens would...
Sir, can I guess you put your name
on
the
record?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
He's never done this before.
No, Chair.
I missed it. I apologize.
City of Reedsport.
Senator Monroe got me distracted.
Even though we are one of the smaller communities in Douglas County, which, of course, Douglas County is larger in the state of Connecticut, it is the second most used library. So we have the county seat, which is the Roseburg Library, and ours is the second most frequented, and part of that is because of our economic state. Out on the coast, we have an average household income of less than $35,000. So a lot of people depend on our library services for internet, for books, as Mayor McCollum said, for senior services and so forth. So we provide much more than just basic library services. In fact, of the 3 days a week that we were open last year, we had 31,577 items checked out of our library. And in fact, we had 4,235 people come in and use our computer systems alone. Wi-Fi system was 2,844.
Yeah.
And our summer reading program, which is just for youth, had 208 kids sign up for it. So it is a huge benefit, a huge asset to the community. I'm seeing the nod, so I know everybody realizes what a big deal libraries are. And when the county relinquishes their control at the end of this month, the city is stepping up to assume the role. This funding will be used for transitional funding because we have to buy the licenses and a lot of other things that are going to come up front here we just aren't budgeted for. Reedsport's the only community in Douglas County in full tax compression. We're estimating $188,000 in tax compression losses next year, so every little bit we get counts. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, you have one other library in the county and at Roseburg, is that correct?
Correct. That's the county's
hour away.
An hour away, but is the library card good at both the libraries in the county?
At this point, we're working with the county to maintain those services. So it'll still be, if we have a county library card, then it could be used there as well. Our goal is, because we're more closely situated with Coos County or Lane County on the coast there, that we would actually network with one of them and see if we couldn't provide enhanced services by allowing our citizens to go just 20 minutes north or south and provide or pick up books and so forth. So
great. Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming
thank
out.
You.
That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 806? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing, open the work session on Senate Bill 806. Senator?
I move Senate Bill 806 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Thompson's moved Senate Bill 806 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 806 is passed with a due pass and referral to Ways and Means. We'll close on that. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 374. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 374 authorizes the Department of Transportation to issue driver licenses, driver permits, and identification cards that meet the requirements of the Federal Real ID Act of 2005. It specifies real ID compliant documents will be known as STAR IDs.
We'll see.
I say that with the full knowledge, Mr. Chair, that this we also have a Dash 1 amendment. Dash 1 amendment makes many changes, which I'm sure I won't steal Senator Hansel's thunder on that. But it changes the name of the ID to a real ID. Mr. Chair, the measure came to us with a subsequent or with a request rather from the Senate President that we add a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr.
Senator,
Chair.
One more time. Senator.
Chair Breyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate Bill 374 and the Dash 1 amendments. Senate Bill 374, the Real ID Bill, is a bill that will be of benefit to most Oregonians. In 2005, Congress passed the Real ID Act in response to the September 11th attacks. The purpose of the act was to create a minimum standards for state-issued driver's license and identification cards in all 50 states. These cards would be used as the official acceptable identification for all federal purposes, such as boarding airplanes and entering federal buildings. Oregon in 2008 began to become a Real ID compliant with Senate Bill 1080. The bill stated people when applying for driver's license or official ID cards had to provide proof of citizenship or legal presence. In 2009, however, Oregon passed Senate Bill 536. This law prohibited DMV from implementing any further part of the Real ID Act without federal funds to cover the cost. Since 2009, the Oregon Department of Transportation has asked for an extension for 8 years from the Federal Department of Homeland Security to hold off on the implementation of the official cutoff timeline. Oregon's extension expires effective July of this year. Through conversations with Amy Joyce, it is our understanding we will not receive any additional extensions. If we do not pass Senate Bill 374 or something like it, Oregonians will not be allowed to gain access to federal facilities and nuclear power plants or board domestic flights using the standard Oregon driver's license. This will cause untold hassles and affect Oregonians who work at the Hanford reactor and live in my district. Per the Department of Energy, there are about 40 people who will be affected. No one knows for sure which federal institutions will need real ID to gain entrance, but it could include federal courthouses and the Columbia River dams, of which three of the four are in my district. Then perhaps the biggest impact, effective January 22nd, 2018, in 9 months from now, no Oregonian will be allowed to board domestic commercial flights using the Oregon driver's license. They must have a real ID card or passport, which I suspect most Oregonians do not have. Senate Bill 374 will create an identification card that meets the congressional requirements for the Real ID Act. We'll be able to gain access to federal facilities. Our constituents will be able to go to work, board planes for traveling, for business or personal. Some of the aspects of this are spelled out in the bill are as follows. DMV will need to retain copies of our legal presence documents, such as birth certificates, passports, immigration papers. They will need to be stored for 7 to 10 years. They already require those, just at the storage that is added to it. Re-verify legal presence and our Social Security cards upon each renewal. Change the design of the card so it can easily be seen to be Real ID compliant. Many of the states simply put a gold star on the top corner. The Dash 1 amendments changes the following. If an Oregonian wants a Real ID card, it will be 100% voluntary. The current driver's license will still be offered and allowed in the state. If you don't want the Real ID or don't have a need for it, you're not obligated to obtain it. Real ID cards will have an additional cost, and 100% of that cost will fall on the individual who wants the enhanced ID card. Regardless of your stated renewal time, at the time of your Real ID card is obtained, it will be issued for 8 years, similar to the present practice. ODOT is currently updating their computer systems, and can easily incorporate the necessary pieces for implementation of the Real ID. Members of the committee, I believe that now is the time to act on this. We need to do all we can to allow Oregonians to travel by plane, work in federal facilities, and have access to the locations they need. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. And for the record, I am in support of the Dash One amendments.
Questions, Senator Monroe?
Yeah, those cards, you said the people that are getting the card would pay the full cost. Did they know approximately what that cost would be?
We'll have a DMV will be up next, Senator.
Oh, okay. Well, I just thought the good senator might know. He knows everything.
I think he does, but that's probably more appropriately directed to them.
Oh, all right.
If I were to answer the question, I would.
He'd say $15
to $20. $15
to
$20. Okay. Seriously, and I'll answer, Chair and Senator Monroe. I sort of envision it like a vanity license plate. If you want it, you can get it. You pay more for it, and it's yours to use. But that's sort of the same philosophy of the Real ID card.
Any other, Senator?
Since a passport is already available for us to use, what's the difference between a passport and your souped-up driver's license?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerard, there's a couple things. One, it's more expensive. It's $120 now, I think, to get the passport. My experience when I've traveled overseas with my passport, which I do have, it's much more awkward to use. You can't carry it in your wallet, in your purse, and the other issue with it for me is that it's worth a lot of money on the black market, and it's very difficult to replace. So it's just more bulky, more inconvenient. If you have a passport, you can use it. You wouldn't have to get the license plate. And you could also, for I think $55, get a card that you could put in your wallet as well.
Yeah.
But it's more expensive, and it takes longer to get it than it would be for the license plate.
That remains to be seen.
Remains to be seen. That is true. That is true. Won't be as long.
I'm good.
Good enough. Any others? Thank you, Senator. I did want to note that some folks from ACLU, which will be testifying in a few minutes, have some concerns about the security requirements. Not opposed, but my understanding is they're working with DMV on some potential changes for cybersecurity.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's bring up DMV, Tom and Amy. Mr. McClellan.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and here with the DMV Administrator Tom McClellan. We're going to trade off a little bit on the testimony today. Senator Hansel did an excellent job summarizing kind of the background on Real ID and some of the features of the bill, so I'll just hit some of the other highlights. To do Real ID implementation, the idea behind Real ID is that there are three groupings of types of things that DMV would need to do. It's about the reliability of the underlying information leading to the issuance of a card. The second thing is the security of the procedures and the personnel of DMV and its contractors. And then the third thing is the security of the actual plastic card itself, the resistance to tampering and that sort of thing. So those are the three different types of things that expand into 42 or so different requirements of the federal government to become Real ID compliant. As Senator Hansel noted, again, the penalty for failure to be Real ID compliant, which we are not, as you know, is not any kind of monetary penalty, but is the inability to use that ID for federal purposes. And the big one is to use it for TSA to get on a commercial domestic flight. Again, January 22nd of 2018, if we are not compliant and don't have another extension, you won't be able to use your Oregon driver license or ID card to board a commercial flight. And then after that, October 1st of 2020 is the next date. And by that time, if you don't have a Real ID compliant card, not just that Oregon is compliant, but the card itself has got the Real ID features, you won't be able to use that credential to get on a plane. Senator Hansel mentioned Senate Bill 536 from 2009. Again, the reason we are not Real ID compliant, or that's kept DNV from becoming Real ID compliant. And then also mentioned by Senator Hansel, and it's very relevant to this topic, although it seems a little tangential, but in 2015, the Oregon legislature authorized DMV to begin a 10-year, $90 million service transformation program, or STP, which is our effort to replace our aging and obsolete IT system and really transform the way we deliver services and products to Oregon customers as the face of Oregon state government. We're nearly 2 years in to that process, and we are in the final stages of negotiation with a vendor for a commercial off-the-shelf or COTS IT vendor. We aren't there yet, but we're in the final stages of negotiation. If we are able to successfully negotiate and execute that contract, the system is configurable to be Real ID compliant, so that is possible, and the negotiations in that process have contemplated the possibility that the legislature might make this policy change during the session.
So for the record, my name is Tom McClellan, a DMV administrator with the Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 374 would repeal the legislation from 2009, which is the prohibitions, basically, that we've had in that eight-year period. It also provides the necessary statutory authorities that we would need to, as far as we can tell, comply with the federal laws and regulations. It does create a two-tiered system, which the default is the credential that we issue today. We would keep the same existing requirements we have today, which is proof of identity, proof of residency in Oregon, a valid Social Security number, or proof of ineligibility for that Social Security number, proof of legal presence in the United States. Those types of things would stay in place for our existing card, as we do today. We check the Social Security number that's provided to us against a federal system. We have an electronic verification of that. We also check immigration documents with a similar process of checking to make sure that it's been recorded with the Department of Homeland Security. Once the person's established citizenship or permanent legal residency with DMV, they no longer need to present those documents, and we're just finishing an eight-year cycle. So if you're coming back to DMV for a renewal, for the standard card, you no longer have to present a birth certificate or U.S. passport. Once you've done that, you no longer have to do it again. Under Senate Bill 374, the -1 amendment, it's more of a choice at that point to apply for a Real ID compliant card, the Oregon credential. From the applicant's perspective, the person will need to show documentary proof of identity, residence, and lawful status. There is a distinction between legal presence and lawful status. And it's difficult to explain sometimes, but the difference, a few examples would be you might be legally present in the United States with a card that's expired, but the Department of Homeland Security will grant you up to 290 days to extend that credential. You are legally present. You don't have lawful status necessarily because that card has expired. Technically, it's no longer, not valid. But they do have exceptions in place, and they call that legal presence. That's the current status we have today for licensure and ID card issuance. The technical Real ID language is that lawful status. So it's a tougher standard for eligibility.
So how does that work, Tom, for people that are here on a student visa or an I-9?
Employment authorization cards, things like that.
Green card.
Chair Beyer, yes, they would either have to provide additional documentation or get the standard card. That's our understanding of it right now. We're in pretty constant communication with the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that we're interpreting these regulations properly. But it's our reading on it that if it's expired, they would not consider it.
So they probably wouldn't have a problem anyway because they would all have a passport.
As far as traveling goes, that's true. Yeah. If that's the reason why they might apply for one. Any non-citizen will need to bring in their documents every time they seek to renew or replace their driver's license. We'll retain digital copies, digital images of all the documents that are used to apply. That's another one that we're trying to get clarification on, but we're, our reading of the regulations is the application and the attestation as part of that application process, and any documents that the person presents, evidence of a social security number, a passport, you know, those types of documents, including residency documents for an address where the person lives. So that's our interpretation of what would need to be retained.
So how do you deal with that, with people who maybe are here, or immigrated here as a refugee, or from other countries where they don't have birth certificates and such? How do you deal with that?
Chair Byer, they're going to use their immigration document. So if they're here legally as a refugee, they're going to use that document for both the identity and the lawful status.
So you just use that?
Yes.
Okay.
And then any residence document they have is for where they're domiciled would be part of this process as well.
Yeah, and Chair Byer, if I may, one conundrum, I guess, or issue with Real ID is that, you know, while the standard documents we use to prove legal presence today are the birth certificate or the U.S. passport, some folks just don't have those things. People who were born at home and that document and that birth was never recorded in the official record. A birth certificate simply doesn't exist. There are just, I would say, just fact patterns you couldn't even make up in your own mind in terms of adoptions and name changes and born overseas to U.S. citizen parents and all these permutations that our folks at DMV have developed an exceptions process to walk through the various ways you can demonstrate that you truly are a U.S. citizen, although you don't have those standards documents. So we have this exceptions process that we use, we feel is quite rigorous and accurate. However, under Real ID, we're not certain that the exceptions process we use today would be acceptable. So I think one of the outcomes under Real ID may be that a person who's gotten one of those exceptions for one of those very interesting fact patterns might not be able to, even using those same documents, be able to show enough to get the Real ID under the federal standard. So that's an issue.
Sometimes it's a surprise. I know until I was applying for a passport, I thought I had my birth certificate. And what I discovered, I didn't. What I had wasn't a, quote, official birth certificate and had to send back to the state of Nebraska. And it wasn't exactly an easy process.
And that's one of those simpler solutions that folks end up with. So anyway, that is an issue.
And Chair Byer, that's a great example, actually. We won't know until we actually submit a compliance package to the Department of Homeland Security for an official determination from them of whether we fully comply.
So I shouldn't push this one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How do your people know that what they're looking at is an official birth certificate? I know the one that was sent to me by the state of Nebraska, for example, looked like a certificate form that you could buy down at a stationery store and had all the signatures and stuff on it, but I could have filled one of those out.
Well, Chair Byer, it's part of its training, part of it's the reference documents that our employees have in the field offices to just refer to, so they can just take a quick look to see, does it look like, you know, what you have presented as an applicant. Again, training. Sometimes there's security features on the documents they can look for. But there are all sorts of documents that we're looking at there.
I know. So
it's a judgment call, you know, by an employee determining. And we also have another set of eyes where it's a large enough office. We'll have two people checking to make sure that, you know, they both agree that this is a legitimate document to be accepted, authentic. So
life was so much easier when we were just doing driver's license.
Yeah, it was.
Senator?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things I'm interested in is the physical characteristics of the Real ID card and how they differ from a driver's license, that the standard driver's license.
So Chair Byer, Senator Riley, what most states have done is put some kind of an indicator, like a star. Some are using a gold star, a black star, in the upper right corner. As you're looking at the card, the upper right corner, as the identifier of a compliant card. So if, which indicates you've gone through all the steps necessary, and that states, you know, employees and systems are all doing what they're supposed to do to issue that type of a card. For a non-compliant card, so once you're issuing that, you would also, on your standard card, indicate, say, on the back of the card, fine print, not for official federal identification purposes. So that's a distinction between the two cards. That's what's required in the federal law.
So that's the only difference?
That is the only difference.
Okay.
Okay. From the agency's perspective, significant changes will be taking place. We'll make, like I said, digital copies, digital images of identity source documents. The law requires that to be retained for a minimum of 10 years. We haven't decided how long we actually would keep them, but 10 years is the minimum. We would also check systems, federal systems, for U.S. passports and birth certificates. There is a passport system in use by a few states right now. It's assumed that we would connect up to that system and be able to verify with the State Department that the passport presented to us has actually been issued to that individual. And then to check with vital statistics for various states as those systems are available to ensure that the birth certificates presented from Nebraska was actually issued to that individual at that particular date. It's also assumed that we would do a check of other states' issuances of driver licenses, say a real ID card issued from another state, New Mexico or some other place. We would be able to verify that card was actually issued to another person in that other state, and that person in another state. That system is also in place. About a dozen states are using that system right now, so we would connect up to that. There would be some changes to the card. I just mentioned that. Our employees and contractors who have potential access to customer records or to change those records must have both a name-based and a fingerprint-based criminal background check conducted. Today, we do a name-based criminal background check on new employees, and we're gradually getting all employees through that process. That's a fairly significant change, at least for our employees and contractors. We would work with our IS solution vendor, the company is bringing in the commercial off-the-shelf system. We anticipate being able to issue real IDs by mid-2020. This is early scheduling, basically. We really don't have the contract in place with this company, but from their experience in other states, they've taken that amount of time to bring vehicles and a driver system in place. So that's what we're assuming for planning purposes. We estimate that about 30% of Oregonians might want this card. And it's hard to estimate what that demand would be, but based on percentages across the country of individuals that have U.S. passports or U.S. passport cards, maybe immigration documents, or just don't travel, just really don't have a need to apply for the card, we've limited to, in our fiscal estimates, of about 30% of people might want that. Not necessarily on day one, hopefully not on day one, that would be spread out over some period of time. But that is a concern for us, and you can expect with that summer 2020 date, in this 2019 session, in a couple of years, we would probably be back asking for some positions for whatever workload we're anticipating at that point. We don't want people waiting 2 hours at a DMV office if we can avoid it.
Of course, that's true of those if you're just looking at people who want to use it to fly, but I still think it's going to be interesting for trying to impanel federal juries.
We'll see. In our materials, we have a map that shows the states and the current status. I think it's near the end of our materials. There are 56 jurisdictions that this applies to. 26 have been deemed compliant. The only neighboring state right now is Nevada. California, Washington, Idaho are not yet compliant. So, in summary, Senate Bill 374 with the -1 amendment would provide the statutory authority to bring Oregon into compliance with the Real ID Act in the summer of 2020. It would provide Oregonians with an option of a standard credential or a Real ID compliant version. Additional identity source documents and fees would be necessary. The bill does include a provision for us to charge an additional fee to recover our costs. It already mentioned $15 to $20 is what we're currently estimating. It is hard to estimate that when you're assuming a new system and a vendor that has yet to come on board yet. We've done some of our estimating with our existing systems, which we don't think that would be a good investment to spend thousands of hours configuring, changing those mainframe systems written in COBOL, and then just throwing that away when the new systems come on board. So the thought is we'll do that with the new systems as they come on board and achieve that connectivity with other national systems that we don't do today as well. Like I said, we may ask for more staffing in the 2019 session.
Tom, I just want to be clear. The dash one amendment, section 5, is fairly clear, and I want to make sure to get it on the record that the cost of issuing the Real ID card will be 100% recovered through any additional fees, and that it is an optional card.
Chair Byer, that is our understanding, what that means, and that we would use rulemaking authority to set that fee at some amount more than what the standard card is. And like I said, $15 to $20 is our best estimate right now to fully recover that implementation cost and the ongoing cost.
Okay. Senator?
So you mentioned that our neighboring states are not compliant. Do you know where they are in the process?
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, state of Washington, I understand they have legislation similar to this where an option would be provided, and I don't know how that will turn out. I'm told it's getting an active hearing in Olympia. California, they're also doing something similar. They're making plans to comply, and they actually submitted a compliance package in September, October of last year. It was denied. But they do plan to resubmit. They have an extension, just like we do, into June 6th. I think it was reported July earlier, but June 6th of this year is when our current extension expires. We think with this bill and the intent to move forward will be sufficient for us to get another extension and to hopefully carry us past that January 2018 date at the airports. If they can grant us another year or even more, that we'll avoid that conundrum at the airports. So,
okay, thank you.
I guess just a technical piece. I assume whatever you put on the card or how you make it, but the real key for TSA people or whatever is probably in the barcode on the back of the card.
Chair Byer, initially they're just going to look to see if it's an Oregon card. They're going to if it's issued by Oregon, and that's the distinction. January of 2018 is whether it's from a state that's compliant or has an extension, and then they really start to look in October of 2020 if the card is compliant. So they're going to look initially at what's on the face or on the back of the card to determine if it's a compliant card. There will be information in the barcode. Machine-readable element of the card to indicate whether it is a compliant card.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you had it made just having to send a little letter to Nebraska. I was born in British Columbia of two U.S. citizen parents, one of whom was born in Missouri, the other of whom was born in Alberta, of U.S. citizen parents.
Good luck with that, Senator.
I had to prove all of that with original documents. Now, my mother was raised in the Depression. She never threw anything away. I had all the original documents. I wrote them a nice letter, and I said, see document A, see document B, see document C. And people told me, you'll never get a passport, never going to happen. 2 weeks later, I had my passport.
There you go. That's a pretty quick passport.
I've had it ever since. And I keep it updated, believe me.
Any others? Seeing that. Why don't you hang on there? Kimberly McCullough? Hang on. She's got some issues that I think you guys are going to talk about, but I'd like to have you both there. Welcome, Kimberly.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd just like to say at the outset that we have had a longstanding opposition to the Real ID Act because of a variety of privacy concerns. And We still have privacy concerns, but we also realize that the state of Oregon is in a difficult position because the federal government has ratcheted up their pressure, and there are places where we have heard about folks being denied access to federal buildings, and we have a lot of concerns about putting the burden on Oregonians for non-compliance if the state doesn't comply. So because of that, and despite our general opposition to the Real ID Act, we've been working very hard to try to craft a policy that both complies with Real ID and also protects Oregonians' privacy to the greatest extent possible. And I've been really grateful to have had numerous conversations with Amy Joyce at DMV, and I'm happy to report that we have nailed down and hammered out most of the details. There are things that are in the original draft bill that we're really happy to see, like the fact that it's an opt-in, involuntary system. There's additional things that we see in the dash one that are improvements, but there's a few things that we still would like to see changed. And I believe that we are very, very close. I would say the one area where we have a bit of a difference of a legal opinion, and I think it's resolvable, is exactly which documents that are presented to DMV have to be scanned and stored. And the question is, are we scanning and storing just the birth certificate, or are we also scanning and storing the Social Security card? Are we also scanning and storing any number of documents that folks bring in, their utility bills or whatever, to establish their home address? So there's a whole bunch of documents that folks are going to be bringing in, and the question is how many of those documents get scanned and stored. We also have some concerns about just the sharing of this data and how that gets shared with the federal government. And I think that we're working on discussing all of this, and I think that we're very, very close to having some resolution. Our goal is not to slow down this train and make it stop. We just want to make sure that we do it right and are dedicated to working through it. I have submitted testimony. I didn't see it up on OLIS just yet, but one of the things that I provided for you is this document right here, that basically it's a little chart that outlines sort of our primary privacy concerns about the data and how the data is handled and what the security protections are. And that way you can take a look at that. If you want to really get into the weeds, I'm happy to talk to any of the committee members in greater detail, but there are a lot of complicated details here, so I will spare you all of them today.
So let me just ask a general question to Tom and Amy. If we give you a week, do you think that you can resolve most of these issues outstanding, or do you think you're far enough apart that I realize you may not be able to resolve them all, but it'd be nice to do that. I do share her concerns about security and cyber, and I will note that this bill requires more documentation to get a driver's license than it does to get a passport.
Which is very strange.
Sure, Byer.
And they also always send all the information back.
Yeah, Chair Byer, and we have been in discussions quite a bit with Kimberly, and it's been good, productive conversation. And I think, I think what it comes down to is what's the minimal amount of documentation that needs to be scanned, the minimal amount of documentation that's required to be shared to get into compliance. That, to me, is the pragmatic question that I think only Homeland Security may be able to answer, and we're going to do our best to get a clear answer from them and as quickly as we can, and we'll provide that information to everyone as soon as we have clear direction.
So I'm not sure I'm getting a clear answer here. What I'm really asking is, we have some time. If we're going to move this, if we give you another week, can you resolve some of these issues?
Sure, by
another amendment.
Yeah, we're going to try our hardest. We think we probably can.
Okay.
Is that one final?
Yes.
So, do I need more than my passport to get one of these?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Lots more.
Yeah.
That's insane. Okay.
Actually, with your passport, you probably can get one.
Yeah, I'm not even going to bother.
Alrighty. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. You've done some really good work. I appreciate it. I still think it's silly that the federal government went this way rather than just creating an ID card.
But yep.
That's Congress. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 374? Seeing none, we will close public hearing.
This one we're going to carry over to a later date this year.
Okay. All righty. And so we're here, right?
Yeah.
Excuse me?
So it's carried over 774.
Okay, just for the record, we'll note that we're carrying over Senate Bill 774. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 757.
Patrick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 757 modifies registration requirements for unmanned aircraft systems used by public educational institutions. This measure comes to us. We have no amendment, no fiscal or revenue impact statements have yet been received. We have Brian Guinea here from the Department of Aviation who's going to read something into the record on this measure, Mr. Chair. That should take care of the matter.
Mr. Guinea. So I understand we may not need this bill.
Good afternoon, Chairman Byers, members of the committee. My name is Brian Guinea. I'm the business manager at the Oregon Department of Aviation. Senate Bill 757 seeks to amend the current statute to reduce the fee for unmanned aircraft system or drone registration for certain educational institutions down to $5. The Department of Aviation recommends that we just abolish the fee for K through 12th grade schools and programs to $0. Just to promote, you know, one hand, the department's promoting public education in some of these programs, and the other hand, some of these fees, even at $5, could be a quarter of the budget for an education program at any one year. So furthermore, we could achieve this through administrative rulemaking, and subject to the approval of the legislature, the department will initiate the process for formal rulemaking at the next meeting of the Oregon Aviation Board on April 20th at the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum.
Okay, so to be real clear, I think you said this, we don't need this bill, you will take care of it through rulemaking.
We'll take care of it through rulemaking, and we'll be happy to report back to the committee once that is complete.
Wonderful. Any questions? Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who feels the need to testify on Senate Bill 757? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate 57, and we're down to
798.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 798. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 798 establishes a state transportation donation fund from which continuously appropriate money to the from the fund of the Department of Transportation for purposes specified in either a gift or donation made to the fund or, if no specific purpose is provided, for transportation projects selected by the Oregon Transportation Commission. The measure has no amendment. It comes to us with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. To that end, we have received a fiscal impact statement, which is essentially indeterminate, and a revenue light statement, so paperwork is in hand, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Senator Canop.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Canop from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Tumalo, Sun River, and Redmond. The reason for my appearance before your committee today is a bill that came out of tragedy in Central Oregon. Back last December, you might remember the weather that everybody was having, and we had it as bad as anyone else. But basically, during an 11-year period, or I'm sorry, 11-day period, we had 10 fatalities, traffic fatalities, and it was just unbelievable. You know, you would see one, and it was tragic. I mean, there was a father and a son, there was a pregnant woman, there was two Portland physics professors, and all of the accidents were slightly different. But there was a period that seemed quite hopeless. You know, it was like day after day. It was almost daily, some fatal accident, and you're just kind of wondering, you know, what is going on and what can we do? And, you know, is there a solution to this? And during that time period, I received, and after, I received contact from several constituents that said, hey, you know, you're our elected official. We need to do something about traffic safety. And so I looked at the possible things that we can do, and clearly, you know, a transportation package and those types of things could make improvements. But I wanted to find a vehicle or an avenue that when people were grieving and grasping for something tangible that they could do, Facebook and GoFundMe pages and those types of things don't seem adequate. And so we came up with the idea to basically kind of create foundations within the Department of Transportation, create a fund, and where people could donate and could rally around a specific cause. Maybe there's barriers that need to be put in place and things like that. And so I wanted to give people an outlet and an opportunity to be able to participate in making our highways safer themselves. And so we came up with this bill, and I know there are kind of roundabout ways through ODOT that somebody could donate. It's not particularly, I think, easy to do. And this fund, I think, would give it a little more latitude for the public to be able to do that. And so that is my request. That is the bill. It is as you can see, it is a one-pager. So it's a lot better than the committee I just came from, where we have PERS bills that are 100 pages long. So this bill is pretty straightforward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
They seem to have left off the emergency clause.
Yeah. Well, as you know, some of us have made a little bit of a issue of emergency clauses, and I honestly didn't request or not request. So
just checking.
Thankfully, yes. So I don't know that emergency clause would be necessary for this, but because we definitely want the Department of Transportation to have opportunity and time to implement the bill if you are so inclined to pass it.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Getting off easy.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator, really just here to offer a few thoughts about the bill and answer any questions that you may have. Senate Bill 798 would require the agency to set up and manage a separate account to receive donations through state treasury. Oregon law currently allows state agencies to accept gifts and donations. ODOT has a process for how we receive donations today, and while it's rare, in the last couple years, we've received two of them, one for a specific project and one as a general donation. If this bill becomes law, we would set up a donation fund through state treasury to track the donations.
So you're not opposed to the bill? It will give you a place to store money?
Mr. Chairman, just formalizes the process more than we have today.
I would think it would be rather rare, but...
Yeah.
Questions of Paul? No questions? No? Good. I guess not, Paul. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to discuss Senate Bill 798? Why is there subsequent referral?
Because it would create a fund, Mr. Chair, so that...
Okay. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 798 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 798 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion. Is there any opposition? There is none. It's done. Let's open a public hearing on a real quick. Close public hearing, or the work session on 798. Open public hearing on Senate Bill 782. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 782 directs the Department of Transportation to adopt rules that specify that a manufacturer's certificate of ownership or a manufacturer's bill of sale is valid evidence that a person owns a vehicle. This measure currently has no amendment, but I am under the impression, Mr. Chair, from speaking to the requester, that an amendment may be forthcoming on the measure, so we do not currently have fiscal or revenue impact statements, Mr. Chair.
Okie doke. Amy, you want to start? Or let them go first? Okay. Jim?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, appearing today for Enterprise, and my role is simply to introduce these two expert witnesses, Sabrina Ruckowitz, who is the Vice President and General Manager for Oregon for Enterprise, and Liam Collins, who is the Vehicle Acquisition Manager for Enterprise for Oregon.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. Chair Byers, members of the committee, thank you for your time here today. We do appreciate it. Senate Bill 782.
Well, I need your name, please.
Oh, Sabrina. I apologize. For the record, my name is Sabrina Ruckowitz. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 782 is designed to allow a bill of sale or a virtual bill of sale to be used for proof of and evidence of vehicle ownership. This is something that primarily impacts the rental car industry as opposed to the individual purchaser of a vehicle. Rental cars, as a general rule, are shipped direct from the manufacturer as opposed to you or I going to a dealership to purchase a vehicle, at which time the MCO and all the paperwork happens, and in the interim you receive a little paperwork that you can tape up into the back of your vehicle that says that you can drive the car. For us, putting a paper license plate in the back of a vehicle is not a safe decision, being the fact that we have so many people that will be renting that vehicle and could take this particular plate, et cetera. So we choose not to do that. However, the electronic bill of sale happens immediately. What we would like to do is start that process with the DMV in a more timely and efficient manner, because sometimes the MCO, which is what the DMV accepts, does not arrive until later in the process. Now, through the testimony that you received, there was discussion of the old system and the new system that the DMV has. In the old system, we were able to start this process and hold the paperwork once it got into the system and send everything to the DMV, and it reduced our lag time. Today, the moment we use the new system, it holds up, or it becomes an instantaneous change. So the difference being, there's anywhere between 2 to 4 week lag between us receiving our vehicle and our ability to rent the vehicle. So imagine if you bought yourself a brand new car and you had to park it in your driveway for 2 to 4 weeks until you were able to drive it. What we're asking to do here today is something that is done in California, and what we are requesting is very similar to the bill in California. Thank you.
You know, ironically, in January, just before the session started, I rented a car in the L.A. area, and it was a brand new car, never been driven before, and they had the paper thing in the window.
That may be a specific rental car company choice. That's not a choice we would like to do.
Mm.
Chair Byer.
Okay. So I don't know how they do it elsewhere, but okay.
Chair Byer also, and committee members, we are still working with the DMV and working towards getting to a solution that would help us out, so I don't know if we're ready for a work session.
So, Supreme, actually, you want the plates, you want to be able to get the plates themselves?
Yes.
That's the issue?
Chair Byer, we do. The old system allowed for everything to be noted within the system, and it could be held, and we held on to the plates. In 2016, the DMV changed that rule, and everything is handled by the third party. So the third party is held to a 5-day window of having everything available prior to getting the plates shipped to us. Hmm. It's quite confusing.
Okay. Questions? All right, well, let's get DMV up.
All right. Thank you.
Don't go too far.
Chair
Chair Byer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and with me today is Stephanie Zellner, DMV's vehicle programs expert, who will be able to answer the many questions of the details of this situation. And I will say that we are continuing to work on this with Enterprise and with the company called V2 or MVSC, which is the third-party electronic vehicle registration vendor that DMV now works with. The prior testimony was accurate. In 2016, DMV did change vendors of this electronic vehicle registration system that communicates between a vehicle dealer and the DMV to make more efficient processing of dealer paperwork, and then also provides other services to dealers as well. However, none of the time requirements changed during that process, and the only thing that changed was we went to central issuance. So in the past, a dealer kept a stock of plates on hand so they could put a plate on a vehicle immediately when they sold that vehicle, or in Enterprise's case, the vehicle could be used immediately if the paperwork was in place. There were a number of problems with inability to keep track of stock by some dealers. I'm not saying Enterprise, but so the DMV made the decision to go to central issuance. So dealers no longer keep the plates with them. When the process goes through to the EVR vendor, then the plates go out. However, in the past, really there shouldn't be any change because the law requires that the MCO, the manufacturer's certificate of origin, which is the MCO or kind of the birth certificate of that vehicle, that document needs to be in hand before plates go on the vehicle. So it really shouldn't have been a problem or a change from what happened, what's happening now. Our understanding also is that Enterprise is having this issue with a very small number of vehicles. I think perhaps the implication was this is happening all the time. I think this is, from what we've been told, a very small universe of vehicles where this happens. The MCO is viewed by DMV as really an important document to demonstrate ownership. And simply receiving some data isn't a good indicia of ownership. And also, I want to mention that while we are continuing to work with these folks, what we're talking about is a process change and potentially a systems change. And as you heard from the earlier testimony on another bill, DMV's got quite a bit on its plate right now with the STP and now potentially Real ID. So we are trying to minimize changes to our existing system before we go to a new one. That is my testimony.
So how big of an issue is this for DMV? I mean, with volume of vehicles.
Do we know how many?
Not really.
I think from what I had heard, I think it was something like 5% of Enterprise's vehicles per month, and I think they maybe do about 1,000 vehicles. I'm sure the folks could tell you more. But so the question is, do we change a process and go a different route for a relatively small number of vehicles that could be handled?
I'm assuming you're talking about Enterprises. I'm assuming if you have a different process, you'd want to apply it to all rental companies.
Well, Chair Byer, I potentially, although as I understand it, this is the only entity that's expressed any problems with the current system.
Questions? Is there any solutions?
Chair Byer, we've got a meeting, I think it's next week, between an Enterprise and DMV and V2, that electronic vehicle registration entity, trying to discover if there's a way to work around this. So we're still actively trying to figure something out.
Mr. Chair.
Senator?
So is it I'm going to say it wrong.
STP.
Yes, STP. Thank you. That's easier. Is that going to change anything in this realm? Will it change any of the process?
Do we know yet?
Chair Beyer, for the record, my name is Stephanie Zellner with Department of Transportation, Driver Motor Vehicle Services. Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, we don't really know yet, but it is possible that with a new vehicle system through STP, that we will be looking at more electronic transactions, whether that includes accepting ownership documents electronically or not. We don't have an answer to that yet, but we are looking towards an easier way to accept transactions electronically. Mm-hmm. So it's possible.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought. Okay. Transformation.
So when would you be in a position to do something about that?
Transportation transformation.
Chair Beyer, we're still in negotiations with the STP vendor, but assuming those come to fruition, they would get started in June or July, and a vehicle system would be, in theory, up and running 18 months later.
When?
18 months later, so a little less than 2 years from now.
I mean, it would seem like you could, I mean, particularly that's a pretty narrow class of registrants that you're talking about, if you're talking about just rental businesses, and seems like you could accept that if they had some kind of electronic documentation. Not sure. In lieu of, but pending the other, that they have to submit that.
Yeah. Chair Beyer, I think that's going to definitely be part of the discussion that we have next week when we all sit down together.
So you can sit down next week?
I believe that's right. Is
that
right?
April 5th.
April 5th, we're meeting.
A couple weeks.
Okay. So we probably should not act on this before you sit down and talk with them.
That would be great, Chair Beyer.
All right.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much. I should have asked. Is there any other questions? Okay. So what I'm hearing is you guys are meeting and talking about this. Cool.
Great.
All right. Is there anybody else who wishes? Did I have somebody else? No. Does anybody else wish to comment on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing, and I think that takes us to the end. Thank you very much, everyone. We are adjourned. Everyone, we are adjourned.